That is Bow Wow Wow from Last of the Mohicans, wrapping up that set of music. Yeah, an album that came out in 1982. Speaking of 1982, that's when Adam Ant released Desperate But Not Serious from his Friend or Foe album. Now, the unique thing about putting those two songs back to back is that the Adam Ant release, Friend or Foe, was the first release he did as a solo artist or without the Ants. And where did the Ants scurry to? Well, many of them scurried to Bow Wow Wow. Well, actually, Malcolm McLaren plucked them and assembled Bow Wow Wow, but that's where a lot of the Ants went. And then he put out Friend or Foe, Desperate Not Serious. And then I started the entire set. Pittsburgh's own Gothies doing their version of the Monkees' Pleasant Valley Sunday. Now, I don't know if you heard, a few weeks ago I did a program, and for about 2 hours of that program, I featured only music from albums released in 1982. So this is some spillover stuff that's never made that show, and I have more spillover stuff for future shows that you'll hear in later dates. In fact, there will be an encore presentation, a bonus encore presentation floating out there at some point of that show where I only played music from 1982. It was such a great show. I enjoyed it. Hopefully you'll enjoy it. And that's going to come up in the future. My name is Paul. This is a show called Viva La Mock. This is an encore presentation of said program. You can hear this show in its entirety, in its original form, and usually live on a Friday night here on 88.3 FM. Starting at 9, just to let you know, so if you need to sleep in, and we take it to about 1 a.m. That's what happens. In the meantime, if you ever have a suggestion for a song to include on a program of Viva La Mock, send me an email at wrctrequest@gmail.com. Again, wrctrequest@gmail.com. As always, thanks for listening to this program. My name is Paul. I'm the Mockster.
Okay, Kevin Amos here, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. This is Ebony Spectrum, and this week in Ebony Spectrum, we're taking a listen to The Don Lemon Show. Here we go.
Good evening, everyone. You know what that music means. It is time for The Don Lemon Show, live at 5, and I have the perfect guest to discuss everything that's going on. Well, Donald Trump, will he go toe-to-toe with Kamala Harris with just 2 weeks until the previously agreed upon September 10th presidential debate? It takes place between the two campaigns, but the communication has broken down. Drop the mic or not drop the mic? That's what we're discussing. So what is the issue here? The issue, when I say that, is to mute the mic or not mute the mic. You know, when they're when one person is talking, the previously agreed upon terms were, one of them was that the mics would be closed or not open to the person who's not speaking. The Harris campaign wanted to change that. They wanted the mics open. I think they believed that it would show the real Donald Trump and that Donald Trump would say something that would get him into trouble speaking to Kamala Harris when he's not supposed to be speaking. Donald Trump's campaign is saying, listen, we agreed upon those terms initially with the president, Joe Biden. We expect those rules to stay into place. So we'll see what happens. There's some talk that maybe they've agreed upon the mics being closed, but I don't know. We need to check into that. So we're going to break it down with Bill Kristol's here. You see him up there on your screen. He is the founding director of Defending Democracy Together and the editor at large of For the Bulwark. I love the Bulwark, by the way, Bill. And he writes a very brilliant morning newsletter called Morning Shots. I love the newsletter, but I love the Bulwark. You've got great people over there. By the way, thanks for asking me to join. That's sarcasm. How are you?
Haven't we asked? You've been on with Tim Miller, haven't you? I believe
I have been on with Tim Miller.
Okay. Yeah. I'm too thin-skinned about that. No,
and
I'm
with
great.
Sarah as well.
Sarah too. Yeah, I'm great. Yeah. That's right. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great.
You survived Chicago?
I survived Chicago. I'm a little scratchy. You know, I'm worried that it may have been a COVID spreader. Are you hearing that?
I mean, I wasn't there. I was at the beach for the week with the family and previously scheduled. And so I've heard other people say that they suspect that. But I think maybe people suspect that of any large event these days. So.
Yeah. And it would not be surprising. So, Bill, let me ask you about this. I want to roll this because we have some breaking news that we got to talk about a lot. We're going to talk about the convention. We're going to talk about the debates, the mic situation. But there is some news as coming in just as we're speaking now. Let's roll this. This is a Fox News alert.
All right, some news just into us right now where the special counsel Jack Smith has returned what they're calling a superseding indictment against Donald Trump in that D.C. case. It doesn't mean it's more. It just means it's more focused, I guess. Jeff Spunt on all of that right now. Sir.
Yeah, hi, Neil. It is exactly a little bit more focused. In fact, the indictment itself, about 10 pages shorter than the original indictment from last year. So the same four core charges are included on this indictment. The reason that Donald Trump was reindicted, if you will, is because the Supreme Court came back somewhat in his favor on July 1st of this year, telling Jack Smith, the special counsel, essentially in layman's terms, you need to go back and rethink about your case before District Judge Tanya Chutkan. This was supposed to go to trial on March 4th, but it was delayed because of the Supreme Court. So while all of these four core charges stay here relating to Donald Trump, the man and the candidate, some of the officials like Jeffrey Clark, the former DOJ official, have been taken out, and this is a much more focused indictment. I also want to point out, Neil, that this is dealing with a new grand jury, so this grand jury did not hear anything about the other indictment from last August 1st of 2023. They only heard the facts in this case.
Okay, what does this mean? We got it. Okay, so Bill, let's talk about that. They call it a superseding indictment. And the reporter there stated it, I think, fairly well. This one is more focused, and I think it takes out or gets rid of some of the things that hung them up with their last indictment. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, I think the Supreme Court's immunity decision, which was very notorious, I think you can say, extending this extraordinary amount of immunity to Trump, also seemed to immunize some of the conversations he would have had with government officials. Mm-hmm. And Trump and Smith had cited some of those in the first indictment. And I think as a matter of just caution, just so they couldn't challenge him later, a year from now to 3 years from now, whatever, if Trump's ever convicted of anything, he took that out to make it sort of consistent with the Supreme Court. But was bending over backwards to be consistent with that Supreme Court decision. I think it's Smith's trying to show that he believes he has a case. It hasn't been fatally damaged by the court, and he thinks it's important that it go to trial. Obviously, it's not going to trial before Election Day. But I think Smith really wants to make a point about the rule of law and that he can't control the schedule. He can't stop the Supreme Court from taking its time to resolve appeals. But he's going to bring this case, which he thinks is, you know, a legitimate and just case to bring.
Well, when you say if it even goes to court, that is shocking to me, Bill.
Well, if Trump becomes...
Is he ever going to be held to account for anything?
I mean, no. Well, we don't know. A lot will depend on whether he wins or loses. If he wins, probably not. If he loses, maybe, maybe not. I mean, I do think it's a good lesson for all of us. The courts were a guardrail for democracy in 2020. And they really were, I think, in terms of tossing out all these fake challenges and being pretty stiff, including the Trump-appointed judges, in not letting Trump use the court system to excessively delay or muddy the waters. Just the appeals caused some delay in muddying the waters, but the courts were, it was helpful that 60 different cases all got thrown out. But there are now many more Trump appointees on the court settled in. And it turns out that these guardrails aren't quite as strong as you might have hoped, depending on what the challenges are. When Trump literally tries to overturn an election after November 3rd, after Election Day, it's not, you have to be pretty far gone to start sustaining that kind of stuff in a court. But this kind of stuff, which he's done on this, which his lawyers have argued in this case and on the case in Florida, on the documents, you know, you can be a pro-Trump judge and find a lot more, I don't know what's the right word, kind of colorable excuses, you know, to find ways of letting Trump off the hook. And I think it's a good lesson that, you know, we all thought, I mean, many of us thought the courts will hold Tim accountable for January 6th. And then when the document stuff came out, I think you and I discussed this in real time on, you know, on your show. I mean, that seemed like a cut and black and white, cut and dried case. And here we are, almost September of 2024. And not only has they haven't even been trials, they haven't even been hearings that are publicly almost that are that have brought any of the evidence to light. So he has played the system effectively, I've got to say.
I think I've been gone a year and a half, maybe more, from cable news, and we talked about it even years before that. So Jesus. Okay. Well, let's talk about this latest controversy. I want to play some sound. It's from me on MSNBC last night, breaking down why I think Trump is suddenly so skittish about this debate. Here it is.
Let me just start by asking you about this sort of back and forth. I mean, I strongly feel that the Harris team pushing to unmute Trump's mics is smart. What do you think?
I think it's smart as well. By the way, thank you for inviting me on, Jen. I really appreciate it. I think it is really smart. You know how they say sunlight is the best disinfectant? I wish I had something witty to say about audio as well. But I think we should hear exactly what Donald Trump is saying and how he is treating a woman on stage as she is speaking, because he is perplexed now. I think he's found himself in a situation that he's not used to finding himself in, and that is answering to a very smart woman. And in this particular case, he is answering to a black woman. Mm-hmm. I think that he's on his heels now. He doesn't know how to respond to her. He was hoping that he would be going up against the president, Joe Biden, and now he's going up against this black woman, and she's found all this popularity, and she's closing the polls, tightening the polls, and he doesn't know what to do. He's losing his mind. And I think the Harris campaign knows on that stage he is prone to, you know, have a fit and say something that'll get him in trouble.
Bill Kristol, what do you make of my analysis?
Brilliant, really perceptive. I actually agree with it. Therefore, it was brilliant and correct. You know, what's funny, just step back a second, though. It was the Biden campaign that insisted on the muting of the mics, right? That was there. They thought it was, I don't know why they didn't want Trump to interrupt Biden, I take it. It ended up helping. I mean, Biden had bigger problems at the debate than this, but it ended up helping Trump. And I remember saying at the time, I thought this was crazy. This is going to help Trump. He gets to speak for 90 seconds. You can't expect the moderators to really interrupt him. It's hard to do that. You've been there.
Why don't they ever listen to us, Bill? I was like,
I know. So the moderator can't interrupt him. The other candidate can't interrupt him. He just can lie for 90 seconds. Then after 90 seconds, the other candidate or the moderator might say, well, wait a second. Wait, well, you said this 45 seconds ago. But, you know, that's a lifetime in television, right? I mean, it's already gone by. He's already made his point. So the notion that it was going to help Biden as opposed to Trump, I thought it was always crazy. And I think the Harris campaign has correctly decided that it's partly about his, as you very well explained, his inability to restrain himself in being rude, to say the least, to Vice President Harris. But I think it's also about, they want her to be able to say, wait, you know, not for every lie, because that would be interrupting every 8 seconds, but occasionally say, wait a second, that is false. And fine, she can't really, then the moderator will say, you know, Vice President Harris, let former President Trump finish. But nonetheless, you get a kind of moment there where you stop the lying. I think they want her to be able to do that. They want to show that she's strong enough to do that, because, you know, one of the implicit issues in a campaign like this for someone who doesn't have, I mean, she's vice president, but she hasn't really, you know, she hasn't been president the way Trump has. And she's a woman, to be honest, is going to be kind of, is she tough enough, right? Can she be commander in chief? And one way you show that is by it's not really prove anything about dealing with foreign leaders, but it'd be, you know, punching Trump in the nose, I think will be an important part of this debate for Harris. Not every time, she spend most of the time about her own record, her own agenda, but occasionally showing the toughness to do that. And that might mean interrupting him. So I think they both to show Trump up, but also to give Harris an opportunity, they'd like to have the possibility to at least interrupt occasionally, you know?
What does a win mean for her? What does she have to do to win? Does she simply have to stand there on the stage and get through it, or does she have to deliver a knockout blow?
You know, I'm not sure, probably sort of in between, I'd say. I mean, we'll know more when some of the polling from the convention comes out. I don't think the bounce is going to be quite as high as people think. She'll be ahead, I would suspect, going into the debate. I think she'll be ahead 3 points, not 8 points, which means she really needs to do well. I think it'd be a mistake to be too cautious, actually. I think she really needs to be pretty aggressive, but mostly about herself. I mean, I think the convention was a huge success. Her 5 weeks so far has been a big success. A lot of the public still doesn't really know her that well, though. You know, they might have seen some clips. They might have seen the convention speech. So I think this is the time when she needs to mostly think about how she's presenting herself, her agenda, her bio, her agenda to the public, and then 25% of the time also showing she's tough enough to stand up to Trump. I don't think she even needs to make the case against Trump. That's all out there. People believe it or they don't, but there's nothing new to be said about that. She needs to think a lot about, and her team needs to think a lot about how she comes off in this debate. And that's mostly the positive message about her. But I think part of it is showing that she's tough enough basically to take on Trump.
Man, I've been going to the Bill Kristol School of Analysis because I agree with everything you said. I want you to hold that thought when you talked about, you know, the public not knowing her. But what is a win for the former President Trump?
You know, just that she gets flustered, that she doesn't look able to answer him, that he just hammers. If he could be disciplined enough and just say over and over, you said the border was in good shape in 2021. Do you still think that? You think there was no problem here the last 3 years? What about this Minnesota bail fund or whatever it is that you asked people to give money to and it bailed out a couple of people who committed pretty terrible crimes? I mean, do you feel any remorse about that? What about Afghanistan? How come you've never spoken to the families? I mean, if he could be disciplined enough to just be relentlessly go after her, I don't know how effective the attacks would be. I don't know how fair they would be. Most of them wouldn't be very fair, but she could then get a little, the question is, could she handle those? I mean, oh, look, she could handle them. I think she's an experienced political figure. She'd have rebuttals. And then I think she'd be fine. But what if she gets a little rattled? What if she doesn't answer one or two of them?
Loses her train of thought.
Yeah. I mean, that would be, I think if she, so I think it's, if I were the Trump team, that's what I'd be working on. Trump's not going to be a gentleman. He's not going to pull his punches. I don't think defending his own record again, I don't think that makes much sense. People know all about Trump. But making it seem that she's not quite strong. You know, Biden was pretty strong in 2020 against Trump, right? When Trump went after him, you know, and he kind of pushed back pretty hard. I think that would be the key for the dynamic of Trump and Harris. That in that respect, I think could be pretty important. The debate's important. I mean, it's usually they don't matter much, but usually the races are kind of settled in by Labor Day. And then the debates come and people already kind of know what they think. They like the incumbent president. They don't like the incumbent president. They've seen both candidates through long, very long primary campaigns, right? This is so unusual that the debate really matters a lot, as the convention mattered much more than
as a VP pick, I think.
Those three things. Doug Sosnick, who, you know, the former Clinton political director, said, I usually say in speeches that there are three things the media will focus on that don't actually matter much: VP pick, convention, debates, because the campaigns, it's already settled, you know what I mean, when those things happen. And this is the opposite. All three of them really matter in this campaign.
Yeah, which is, you know, unusual. And I think the VP pick, as we said, that matters. I think it matters a lot more than it did before. Okay, so speaking of the Bill Kristol School of Political Analysis, one more piece I want to play for you of my appearance last night on MSNBC, because I said something that some folks seem to be a bit surprised about. Jen Psaki was asking me about my interactions with voters throughout. I took a road trip to the DNC. I did the eastern states, you know, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, et cetera, New Jersey. And I, you know, I confess to her that there were actually a great number of folks who were either largely or entirely unfamiliar with the vice president, as you just stated. Similarly, watch this.
Is there anything, what did they think about Harris? Did they have anything to say about her?
They did have, it depends on where you are. We went to a number of different battleground states in Pennsylvania, Ohio, we were in Michigan, Indiana, on our way, obviously, Illinois, on our way to Chicago. And it sort of depended on where you were. I should say Philadelphia, was a bit more liberal, and the answers to the questions about her and him were quite different. But for the most part, in Pittsburgh or in the Jersey Shore and in Atlantic City, in Ohio especially, many people did not know who she was. Right. They weren't familiar with her. So I think she has to reintroduce herself to the public. But for him, I think that they thought that he's better for the economy, and that, again, that he gave them, that he brought money into the community, and that, or that he was on Black people's side. What do you think?
I bet you got a little reaction to that at the end. I agree with you. Look, the data shows this. One reason Biden was behind is that it was very clear in these polls beginning in late 2023 that people thought the economy would be better under Trump than it was under Biden. whether that thought is correct, whether the data support that, whether they have a rosy view of the past, whatever, you know. But that was one reason Biden.
It sounds just like me. I said last night that people romanticize the past.
Okay, well, there you go. No, one reason I was very strongly in favor of Biden not running again was I think that's a very hard thing to overcome. If you have the most recent ex-president against the current incumbent president, people have seen those both in their own heads in real time, right? And if people think the ex-president was better for them than the current president, how do you turn that around exactly? It's not a matter of rhetoric, right? That's what they think. They live through it. They may be. So I think Harris is much better as a candidate for change in that respect. It's not my, you know, what I did versus what you did. It's what Trump did, which is problematic, and he's never had majority support, versus what I can do and will do. And that's a very different dynamic in the race. That's why it's changed so much. But I also very much agree that people didn't know her. Sarah Longwell found this in focus groups. You were on with her on her focus group show once, I remember. And, you know, people would just say, I don't really, never seen her for more than 20 seconds. And of course, when you think about it, they never have. She never gave a speech to the nation after what, the vice presidential debate in October, I guess, of 2020. Not only a speech to the nation, she was almost never even on a TV program that had national reach, right? She did what vice presidents do. But so people saw tiny snippets of her. They got the impression that she wasn't a very powerful vice president, that the Biden team didn't include her much in some things. They had one or two snippets of her laughing awkwardly, or the opposite. They liked her because she seemed human and interesting as a person. But I think the degree to which she had to reintroduce herself, her team understood that. That was the point of those last 4 or 5 weeks. And the Trump team, I think, blew a bit of a chance to define her negatively. I really expected them to come out of the blocks the moment she was announced and say, San Francisco liberal, soft on crime, failed borders are, here are the three things you need to know about her. Here's tens of millions of dollars of ads saying this. Here's Trump saying it every day. And they didn't, actually. Trump said a million different things. He said she wasn't really black, you know. And they totally messed up. I do think this was an important moment, though, in the campaign. They kind of, I'm not sure it would have worked, the attack lines they had, but you can imagine coherent attack lines that might work. And they just never really developed any. Harris team did an excellent job of reintroducing her. And she did an excellent job at the convention. I don't know if you were struck by this. I thought the first part of her speech, the bio part, was very deftly done, very skillful. She didn't, you know, those parts are usually kind of awkward, right? I did this, I did that. You seem self-important, or it's boring, sort of. Talking about her mother, talking about the whole, putting it all on the prism almost of her experience and with her family, her mom, an American immigrant story, an immigrants work your way up story. It was really very effectively done, I thought.
You're right. And so the concern, I think, I thought the issue would be for both sides is that he didn't have a long period to sort of, you know, tarnish her, right? To come up with a narrative about her. But also she doesn't have a long period for people to get to know her. So I thought at the convention, she did a very good job of tackling that the best that she could, right? Because time would take care of a lot of that, and she doesn't have time to be able to do that. Yeah. I want to shift and talk about something that I talked about with Tim Miller on the Bulwark podcast. The two of you discussed a quote, some of the people best suited to make the case against Trump are the jilted cabinet members and others who worked with him during doing the right thing is never the wrong thing. Talk to me about that. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, Tim wrote this excellent piece and he and I have talked about it a lot and you talked with him about it some. Kinzinger did a very good job speaking on Thursday night, I thought. Former Lieutenant Governor of Georgia, Jeff Duncan. I thought
Jeff Duncan was the best. I loved his speech, by
Wednesday
the way.
Wednesday night. Yeah. But you could have had, there are plenty of people from Vice President Pence on down who say they won't vote for Trump again, or suggested that at least. Pence has said it. Some of them won't be for Harris, so they'll be saying you can't sit it out, which isn't nothing, incidentally, and is worth probably publicizing more. But a lot of them are open to speaking, maybe eventually will endorse Harris. But they haven't come forward quite as much as they should have, in my opinion. It is a choice of the two of them. They've seen Trump up close. They have a certain credibility. I mean, if you may not like all these national security advisors and cabinet members and stuff, but they can say, they don't have to go into detail. They don't have to repeat confidential conversations in the Oval Office. They just have to say, I saw him close up for 1 year or for 4 years in the Oval Office. And I'm not going to get into details. I'm just going to tell you this. My judgment, if you care about my judgment, is he should not be president of the United States again, period. Mark Esper, the former defense secretary, should say that. Jim Mattis should say it. McMaster should say it. John Kelly should say it. They don't all have to say it at the convention, but they should say it sooner rather than later. And I think Tim is, you know, distressed, and I am too, to some degree, that more of them haven't stepped up, and they're kind of, you know, they'll give an occasional interview and you get the impression they don't like Trump much, you know, and they, yeah. he was erratic and he was this, but they don't just flat out say he should not be president again.
Who was on, is it Mattis or McMaster? One of them was on with Anderson on CNN.
Yeah, McMaster just the other day, I think. Yeah,
the other day. Saying he was making the case, correct? Did he make it adamantly?
I mean, he makes the case about how, you know, undisciplined and foolish Trump was in some ways, but they don't quite bite the bullet. And I think it would help if he, for some voters out there, especially military types, and people who respect that, and McMaster deserves respect, and say, you know what, this guy, he's a conservative. He doesn't agree with Harris on a lot of things, but he said, not just that I don't really, that Trump screwed up, but that we need to vote for Harris. I think it would move some voters.
Yeah. Very smart. I was thinking the same thing. I kept thinking, you know, when I was watching the RNC, and there were no former Republican presidents there.
Yeah, that's right.
And I said, well, if they really, that was a statement, but if they really want to make a statement, they would have spoken, or at least shown up to the Democrats.
I mean, why hasn't George Bush said something? One interview with whoever he wants, right? He doesn't have to say it 20 times. He doesn't have to make a big deal of it, in a sense. He has to do one interview with a respectable journalist on television and just say, you know what? I've been a Republican, obviously, all my life. My father was president, Republican president, and I'm voting for Kamala Harris. It would have a big effect, I think. And I think he is probably going to vote for Kamala Harris, incidentally. So why not say it?
But you know what, Bill? These days, you don't even have to do that. What you have to do is, like, get in front of a thing.
Fair enough.
On your ranch or whatever and say, hi, everyone. This is George W.
Good point.
I'm sitting here or whatever, and I believe in democracy. And for the democracy, I think you should support Kamala Harris. Yeah. That's all you have to do, right? And then everyone, he doesn't have to say anything. It's done.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
So I know that you guys make the case day in and day out for, you know, for whether or not, you make the case for Kamala Harris. But there are folks, you know, in the audience who might have some Republican relatives, Bill, or they may have some conservative friends. What are the best arguments that they can come up with in order to sway them? Help us out here, because I have some.
Yeah, I mean, there's some substantive, let me get their issues, I think. I think actually foreign policy is a very important one for a lot of these Republicans, where they basically agree with the Biden-Harris administration, and they don't agree with where Trump and Vance would lead the country in terms of international politics, Ukraine, NATO, our alliances. And I think that could be pretty important for people to understand the president really matters on foreign policy. Domestic policy, Congress will stop some of the tax schemes. You know, they can check other things. So I think that's important. But honestly, what we found with Sarah Longwell and I have found over the last few years is one of the most effective things is just saying, hey, Mike Pence, Trump's own vice president, John Kelly, his own chief of staff, solid, solid conservatives, obviously. John Bolton, national security advisor, they can't vote for Trump. Doesn't that tell you? That tells you something. They didn't, yeah. You know, that's not their natural inclination. You know, I think that has a, that's why, again, if they would just come make it not just me and Sarah Longwell telling them this, but these people on camera telling them this, I think that really could have an effect.
Yeah. Bill, anything else you didn't get to say? Because I know I have you for maybe 30 seconds, but you guys are doing such a great job. You have any advice for us? Do you think she can win? I know it's, look, what is it, 70 days now? That's what, 15 years in a campaign?
10 weeks. Isn't it crazy? It's a 15-week campaign, the whole thing. We're one-third of the way through. It's really astonishing.
We are, but that's still a long time. It is.
That debate will be very big. I think she can.
Oh, just real quick, I have a better question. You said you don't think the bounce will be that big, and why not, and what effect do you think that'll have, and what does that say?
I just think it's so polarized that she may end up, she may go plus 4 or 5, but she won't be way, way ahead, which makes the debate very big. And I think, yeah, She needs to, hopefully she'll do well. Her campaign has been very impressive so far. And the rest of us need to she needs to focus on herself, though. You and I, this is very much what you were saying. She still needs to introduce herself. She's introduced herself well, but it's like, okay, we're now introduced. Now she needs to further introduce herself and let people be comfortable with her as they vote for her for president, which means people on the outside need to remind people why Donald Trump should not be president again.
Ugh. Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it, sir.
Thank you,
Don. It's good to see you. Come back early and often, all right? And I'm glad you liked my political analysis. Spread the word.
I did like it. That was good. Thanks, Don. It was fun.
Thank you, Bill Kristol. You're the best. I really appreciate it. So that was the great Bill Kristol joining us there. Listen, the man is smart. He's I don't know if he's a former Republican or still a Republican, but he's definitely not for Donald Trump. And I think he and the folks at the Bulwark have made very strong statements. The folks over at the Bulwark, most of them, as you see up there, I have
you guys in the chat behind me up on the screen,
are definitely not for Donald Trump. They're for democracy. They're not necessarily for Kamala Harris, so they are in this case, but they're pro-democracy more than anything. So I am thrilled to continue this conversation with my next guest. There they are. Lauren Brenzel is here. Lauren, let me explain what they do. Lauren is a campaign director for Yes on 4, Floridians Protecting Freedom. Lauren, what does that mean, Yes on 4, Floridians Protecting Freedom? Welcome to the program. Explain yourself, please. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me. Yes on 4 is Florida's campaign to end Florida's extreme abortion ban. We have a ban in place here that occurs before many women even realize they're pregnant, with no real exemptions for rape, incest, or health of the mother. And so a yes vote on this initiative means that we get to end that ban and restore access to reproductive health care to women in the state of Florida.
Yeah. So just to give you a little context, a little bit more, Florida's Yes on 4 activists are looking to follow the path of pro-choice organizers in Ohio, who last year successfully put an amendment to its state constitution defending abortion rights on the ballot, which passed, by the way. In recent years, Florida has severely restricted abortion. In 2022, Governor Ron DeSantis, a candidate for the Republican nomination for president, signed into legislation that banned abortion after 15 weeks. In 2023, Mr. DeSantis went a step further and signed legislation banning abortion at 6 weeks. So, Lauren, give us the latest on your work. How is it working? What's going on?
We know that this extreme abortion ban is incredibly unpopular here. It's a matter of making sure that Floridians know about it. Unfortunately, many people don't learn that there's a ban in place in Florida until they try to access care. So all of our efforts right now are focused on making sure that all voters know that they have the opportunity to end this ban in November. And to make sure that they know what the stakes are, we see our opposition spreading misinformation and disinformation all the time about the purpose of this initiative. And we know that this is the only way that we can protect access to care here in Florida and get politicians out of our exam rooms.
Yeah. Lauren, am I pronouncing your name correctly? Is it Brenzel or Brenzel?
It's Brenzel. You got it.
Oh, good. 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 Thank you very much. Thank you very much. How big of an issue will abortion, do you believe, be in this upcoming presidential election? Because it happened, you know, the overturning of Dobbs or Roe v. Wade, that happened a while ago. People thought that it was, you know, oh, it happened so long ago that it wouldn't play highly in the election. Do you disagree? How highly is it going to play?
I think that this is an incredibly important issue. It has been 2 years since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, but we still haven't seen this issue rectified in any way that's been meaningful for patients in the Midwest or the Southeast outside of these ballot initiatives. For us, this is the one shot that Floridians have in order to ensure that we have any state protections for access to abortion care. And I think that that's relevant for a ton of states. There are 11 states on the ballot this cycle with pro-reproductive health care measures. Florida's just one of them.
Mm-hmm. I want to play something from the convention. And this is assault survivor Hedele Duval speaking about her experience.
I was raped by my stepfather after years of sexual abuse. At age 12, I took my first pregnancy test, and it was positive. That was the first time I was ever told, you have options. I can't imagine not having a choice. But today, That's the reality for many women and girls across the country because of Donald Trump's abortion bans. He calls it a beautiful thing. What is so beautiful about a child having to carry her parents' child? Mm. There are other survivors out there who have no options. And I want you to know that we see you. We hear you. Kamala Harris will sign a national law to restore the right to an abortion. She will fight for every woman and every girl, even those who are not fighting for her.
I'm curious, Lauren, what's your reaction to that?
It is another reminder that these bans cause harm far beyond what politicians imagine they would cause. We see harrowing stories every single day from people who have been denied access to care. And we see people like Hadley who, had they been denied access to care, it would have fundamentally and negatively shifted the course of their life. I also know that we have to do everything we can at every layer of our government to protect this access to care. When I hear about federal strategies, I'm excited to have an entire Congress and Senate and executive office that is pro-reproductive health care. But the reality are these solutions are not trickling down to places like mm-hmm. this Midwest. We need state-based protections in order to ensure that citizens in our own states have access to care.
Mm. Lauren, I want to get some, do I have it here? I just thought about it. Well, let's see. Let me see. Lauren, hold on one second. Okay. I want to read. Don't go anywhere. Oh, here it is. Okay. So Lauren, I'm going to read you something, and this is from my book. And I just thought about it when I heard that from Hadley. And if you go to my new book is called I Once Was Lost. It comes out on September 10th. And that's, I'm not selling it, but I just think it's important to read. I was speaking to a friend about this same issue in the book, and I write about it. Let's see what she says. Okay, so I have this friend, and I'll call her Fiona, okay, Lauren? And that's not her name, but she asked me to use that name for the book. And she was telling me about Ronald Reagan back in the day. You remember The Silent Scream, where yeah. they came with that movie, which was apparently an embryo or a fetus in the womb, and it was screaming because it was in pain for an abortion, and it turned out to be a lie that they put it together. And so she said, this was in the 1980s, and Fiona says, in the late 1980s, Fiona and her husband were happily expecting their second child. She was well into her second trimester when things took a tragic turn. We couldn't afford an ultrasound, so we didn't know anything was wrong until my water broke and I went into labor. They said the fetus had developed in a way that was incompatible with life. And I was like, what does that even mean? And then she goes on to say, basically the organs were growing outside its body. My husband was crying. I was in a lot of pain and scared shitless, at risk of sepsis, and no one was helping me. They said I couldn't have food or water because I might need emergency surgery. And they couldn't give me anything for pain because it might slow down the labor. And they couldn't give me anything to speed up the labor because that would be a late term abortion, which was illegal. I had to wait for the fetal heartbeat to stop. After 3 days, I was just begging, help me, please, you have to make it stop. And the nurse said, instead of begging for an abortion, you should be praying for a miracle. And then she offered to pray with me. I guess that was her way of trying to help maybe, or maybe it was just a way to feel better about herself. She had to suffer for days because they could do nothing for her. They couldn't speed it up. They couldn't slow it down. They couldn't do anything. And she was at risk of dying. This was back in the day before abortions were legal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are we going back to a time like that? We've gone back to a time like that, haven't we?
We're already there and we've been there. So we have women in Florida like Deborah Dobert, who was forced to give birth to a child who died within her arms 94 minutes after being born. Doctors knew that that child would not survive outside of the womb, but because of Florida's abortion ban, she was forced to give birth, knowing full well that that would be her experience. We've seen women like Anya Cook, who lost half of the blood in her body before she was able to obtain medical care because physicians were too afraid to treat her because of Florida's abortion ban. We are already in this place. And if we continue to have these abortion bans on the book, especially in states as large as Florida, we're the third largest state in the nation, we're only going to see an increase in devastation as these bans go on and as the cumulative health impacts continue to grow. Providers are leaving the state of Florida right now. They don't want to practice medicine in a state where they're not able to give their patients access to quality health care. We are seeing patients be turned away from miscarriage management, and we're going to continue to see patient health centers close over the course of the upcoming years if we don't end this extreme ban.
Donald Trump was actually pressed by reporters over the weekend to make clear exactly what he intends to do about IVF and contraception should he win back the White House. Here's his response.
Strong on women's reproductive rights, the IVF very strong. I mean, we're leaders in it, and I think people are seeing that, and votes are being taken, and that's what they've wanted for years. For 52 years, they've wanted votes to be taken by the states, and they wanted Roe v. Wade to be brought into the states, and it's really happening. It's really happening.
What did you make of that?
I think that this is an incredibly tough issue for Republicans. They know that there is a large portion of their base that doesn't support bans on abortion, that supports
access. You believe them?
I believe that there are a large number of Republicans who support access to reproductive health care. And I think it's creating a space where politicians don't know how to rectify that reality. This isn't partisan.
Do you think Republican women will actually go into the voting booth and maybe change? I don't know. I'm just saying, I think that there may be a lot of conservative or Republican women who may go into the voting booth and vote a different way than their husbands or even some of their friends might think.
I think that one of the things for us in the state of Florida, we have a 60% threshold here. We've been running this campaign every single day knowing that we need to get NPA support, we need to get Democratic support, and we need to get Republican support. And so we know that the base is there for us. We need a large chunk of pro-choice Republicans to vote yes on this issue. And we know they're going to, because time and time again, we're being shown that abortion bans aren't popular. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent. These aren't popular policies. And that's why we're seeing politicians who are running for office fail to know how to talk about the concept of abortion.
Mm-hmm. I want to play. This is something that's absolutely brilliant. I think it's brilliant, but it's a terrifying ad on abortion. It's from the Lincoln Project and on today's post Roe v. Wade America. Watch this.
Driver's license, registration.
Here you go, sir. How's your day going?
That's your daughter?
Sure is.
Abigail, right?
How do you know
her? Were you about 8 weeks pregnant? So you've been spotting recently. You've had any cramps or nausea?
That's personal.
You've been taking your prenatal vitamins?
Excuse me?
Are you ticketing me for something?
Where are you heading, Abigail?
To go see my older sister, Natalie.
Well, that's strange. It says here that Natalie's at a concert in Dallas. And your navigation is set to a women's health clinic in one of those abortion states.
We have the right to travel.
Not anymore. Step out of the car.
Please, officer.
Both of you out now. You, sir, are under arrest for crossing state lines to obtain an abortion for a minor under your care. And you, young lady, well, you're under arrest for evading motherhood.
Look, Lauren, that's not hyperbolic. That's not hyperbole. That's an actual reality. They're asking people, you know, if you can turn folks in and you can get for aiding and abetting, you can be arrested and prosecuted. The only thing that was dramatic was the music, but everything else could actually happen in that ad. I mean, I think we should start calling them anti-abortion and start calling them anti-women.
It is a terrifying reality that we're living in. I was thinking the same thing as I was watching that video. It seems like it would be hyperbolic, but we know that there are laws in place like travel bans from accessing state care in access states. We know that, unfortunately, sensitive information about women's health data is being shared. All of this is real, and this is the moment that we have to push back as hard as possible this election cycle on these attacks on our reproductive freedoms.
Mm-hmm. What's your advice to folks? And I'm sure it's going to be get involved and vote, because it's not just you have to. I think what people fail to remember every time, it's not just who's going to be sitting in the Oval Office, but it's about the choices being made, the Supreme Court, and obviously laws on the books are you know, Roe v. Wade being overturned. It's about much more than who sits in the Oval Office.
Yeah, people need to get involved and they need to vote this election cycle. For reproductive health care specifically, it's also really important to know, and I'm not being facetious here, what your laws are locally and how if someone you love in your life needed to access an abortion, you would support them. So there are places like abortion funds and Planned Parenthood where people can find information about how to access care in their community. And everybody should be looking that up, not just people who can get pregnant, but anybody who loves somebody who could need an abortion should be accessing that information. And then also everybody needs to vote on election day. And do more than that. You need to be making calls. You need to be knocking on doors. You need to be sending letters. You need to be having conversations with everyone in your life because there's too much at stake for us to lose this election. We have to take every single chance we can get between now and November 5th to make sure we see the outcomes we want to see.
As you're out there speaking to people, because you're doing the real work, the real footwork, are you finding Republican women sort of, you know, receptive to this?
Yeah. People really don't like abortion bans, and they really don't like them when they don't have any health exceptions. They don't like them when they occur before most people even realize they're pregnant. People are tired, by and large, of politicians being involved in that issue. I really believe that to be true.
What about men?
Men too, maybe a little bit less so than the women as vocally about it. I think that a lot of the women that I've talked to are Republican women, are women who were alive before Roe v. Wade was the law of the land. And they've seen what it looks like in their youth, and they're seeing it again now, and they're offended by that. And so I don't doubt that there are a ton of men who support also, but I think that women and their stories are particularly loud on this issue.
Yeah, I'm looking at some of the folks in the chat. George M. says, Canada has total legal abortion rights for women nationwide. Rochelle says, yes, this is terrifying. John Youngs, I think, believes if abortion plays high, Harris will win Florida on this issue in a landslide. Do you believe that's true? Do you think that this issue is one that can push Kamala Harris into a landslide?
I don't have a satisfying answer in that because my goal really is I come from the world of patient healthcare. I don't come from the political world. I started my career 10 years ago in a call center at a Planned Parenthood talking to patients about funding for care, about OB-GYN appointments, and about abortion. And so for me, the thing that I'm focused on this cycle is winning this election, winning it with 60% in a red-leaning state, and trying to put to bed the issue of abortion. Because if we can do that at a 60% threshold here in the state of Florida, when everybody is undercounting us, then we can show that abortion isn't an issue to be messed with by any politician any longer.
Yeah. Lauren, you were fantastic. Anything else you want to say before I let you go?
Yeah, I really do come from the patient care background, and I always want to ground in this. Florida used to be the number two provider of care in the nation until our 6-week ban went into effect. And if you think about that magnitude of patient visits being lost, and you spread that across the entirety of the Southeast, there are now only 2 states in the entire southern region that have access to care post 6 weeks. We are in a very dangerous situation here, and it is only a matter of time until a woman dies because of these abortion bans. This is the moment that we have to affect the change that we need in this region. And so I have to ask everybody who's watching to go to floridiansprotectingfreedom.com. We have volunteer opportunities both in the state of Florida, but also if you live outside of the state, we have virtual phone banks, we have text banks, we have postcarding opportunities, and you can learn how to get involved with the campaign and support, because this is a shot we have to protect women in the South.
Lauren Brenzel, thank you. Best of luck. We hope that you come back and we wish you much success. Okay.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll see you. So, hi, everybody. I didn't get a chance to speak with you yesterday. And even my mom was like, why didn't you end the show abruptly? I ended abruptly because I had to get to MSNBC and Jen Psaki. Jen was gracious enough to invite me on her program to talk about all the issues she saw, the content that I did during the convention, our road trip halfway across America, kind of almost halfway across America, through eastern states and the battleground states, speaking to voters. Many of you said that the content scared you because you were surprised to see so many people of color saying that they were going to support Donald Trump. Let me tell you. So that content was not, we did not curate it. We did not just put people on, you know, to create a certain narrative. We just went up to people. We asked them the same questions and we put on what they said. Okay. So
someone said, I kicked you guys to the curb. Did you say that? I did not, Jennifer Lynn. I didn't kick you to the curb, Jennifer Lynn.
So anyway, so I've been out and I have a scratchy throat. You can probably tell. And I've been fighting a cold. Hopefully it doesn't turn into the, you know what, as the second gentleman would call it, the Rona. It's so funny. A couple years ago, right? It was either during COVID or right after the quarantine. Second gentleman is Doug Imhoff. Tim and I were in Washington and we were taking a walk in the morning and sitting at a coffee shop was this man. And he goes, hey, Don Lemon. I was like, yeah. And he goes, hey, it's Doug Imhoff, the second gentleman. I'm like, oh, shoot, hi. And I said, how are you? And he goes, yeah, I'm out by myself having coffee. And there was Secret Service around him, but they were being very subtle about it. We didn't even see them. And he said, yeah, Kamala has the Rona. And we laughed because he's so real. He's such a dude. We love him. Anyway, he's great. So anyways, I enjoyed doing this content. It was really, really, really tough work. The people at the convention were so kind to me. The women who invited me there because they wanted my voice to be heard were amazing. The co-chair of the chairwoman of the event, Minyan Moore, Donna Brazil, also some of my folks in Chicago who are notable people who had influence in the convention and in the city. Melanie Spann Cooper also invited me to come in, and it was great. I had great access. But I really want you guys, I'm going to start now talking about this. Because it's important that you buy this book, and not just because Don Lemon wants you to buy the book. I want you to be informed for the election. I want you to buy it for people, because as I was just reading about a woman's right, about women's reproductive rights, we talk about that in the book. We talk about, I talk about my childhood and growing up in a church and, you know, believing that I was an abomination because of what the church taught me. Even now with evangelicals and their teaching, they're teaching now trying to, which makes people like me and women and people who are part of marginalized communities, women who may want reproductive rights or who may be pro-choice, feel as if we are doing something wrong or that is against God or what have you. So, we talk about all of those things. We talk about common sense and sacrifice. I talk about, it's interesting that the Democrats did exactly what I talked about one nation under God, about retaking, about people who are not, you know, crazy right-wing MAGA people owning the flag and owning patriotism. Because the flag and patriotism is for everyone. This country's for everyone. So chapter 7 talks about, I should read I should do certain chapters so that you can understand why this book is so important. But I talk about taking the flag back. It's a one nation under God, is what I call it here. And I'll just read a little bit. This was at my school. So every morning, what we did, I said, the morning ritual at St. Francis Xavier was directed by a nun with a bullhorn who stepped out and ordered us to fall in line, which we did as fast as our mosquito-bitten legs could carry us. Whatever playground hijinks we were involved in, that was over. The nuns were not messing around. We stood outside the door, boys in one line, girls in another,
arms straight forward, fingertips touching the shoulders of the person in front of you to measure as orderly distance as between an orderly distance between. We had to put out our hands on the shoulder of the person before in front of us. We marched inside and stood beside our desks for announcements and morning prayers. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen. No call and response here, just an orderly recitation of words that became so deeply etched in me. I suspect the memory will echo with the final electrical impulse of my brain. While the Lord's Prayer covered all the bases, this one was geared for the moment when you meet God face to face. We weren't so much taught this prayer as we were hardwired with it. And then I go on to say, we remain standing for the Pledge of Allegiance, speaking it with no less reverence. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Sometimes kids forgot themselves and said amen at the end because it felt like a prayer. God was in there. Only this was a prayer for America, or to America, or because of America. Insert your own preposition. It probably applies. The main thing was you had to focus your eyes on the flag and not look away until we spoke those final words, bringing that final phrase home with all the gravitas it deserves, with liberty and justice for all. So it's interesting that I wrote this book. I finished it, 6 months ago or maybe a little bit longer, and then I had to go back and add the stuff in about what happened to me with X and Elon Musk and all that stuff. So that came later. But I talk about taking the flag back, taking back patriotism, and then all of a sudden, the Democrats did the same thing at their convention. Great minds, great minds. This book is so relevant to what's going on, and I would hope that you pick it up before the election. It is called I Once Was Lost, My Search for God in America. New York Times bestselling author. This is the Fire, number one bestselling author. And then on the back, you will see all of these people who I love in my life who wrote things, who wrote forewords for it. Kara Swisher and Sonny Hostin, Clive Davis, Anna Navarro, Lee Daniels. They all wrote very nice things. So go out and go get pre-order the book. Order it for your friends and whatever. And the book tour, I'm going to put my book tour schedule up online so you'll know about that. Okay. So let's see what you guys have to say today. I will purchase the book. Will you be having a book signing in New Orleans? Yes, I will try to make my way to New Orleans, but get the book. And if I make my way to New Orleans, I promise you I will sign it. And if I ever get to whatever town that you're in, I will sign the book for you. And if I can't sign your book, I'll sign a book plate for you and send it to you so that you can put it in the book if you buy it. I promise you I will do that. Beth H. says, I am Episcopalian and put my son in Catholic high school and Lutheran elementary school, was ready for college. Yes, it taught me discipline. Norman Soward says, boo, CNN. I'm not sure why, Norman, you're saying that. Will your book tour come to Toronto, Canada? Glennis Fitzpatrick said, I don't think so at this point, but if there's enough of a demand, I will. I have done my last book tour. I did stuff in Canada, but it was virtual, and we actually had really good sales in Canada. I actually love Canada. I used to go to the, TIFF, which is the Toronto International Film Festival every year. Thank you, Fiercely Independent, for supporting independent media. I really appreciate that. I was strapped by nuns. I was too, as a child, Norm Wilson says. I was strapped as well. And also we had the ruler and the pointer. And what we had to do was when we were getting the ruler and the pointer, they bent our hands back like this so they could get us good. And if they didn't do that, they got us on the butt. What about Cleveland? You know, I was in these places. If there's enough of a demand, I will drive to through America. Actually, I'm actually considering doing another tour going across America. Let me know if you guys would like to do this. Ordering your book, Don, says Sheila Wilson. Thank you, Sheila. Don Lemon for press secretary, says Norman Sorwitz. That would be great. I would love to be press secretary. I'm not sure they would be interested in me. I may have too much of a big mouth, but who knows? Eric C. says, hi, Don. Will you be in South Florida for your book tour? Yes, I have a Florida, I think a Miami date on the book tour. So look that up. We will probably put it online for you. Come to Columbus, Ohio, says Pamela Carter. Listen, I can come to you guys, or I can do a virtual event for you guys. I can send you a book plate, all of those things. So, guys, I love you. I'm so happy that you are still with us for this experience, for the Lemonation. By the way, I met so many people at the convention who came up to me and they said, hey, I'm a Lemonhead. I'm part of the Lemonation. I was so pleasantly surprised and so moved by it. So there are lots of folks out there like us, lots of like-minded Lemonheads and members of the Lemonation. So thank you, guys. I will see you tomorrow. Make sure you check out our content on social media. That way you can find out wherever I am. Make sure you go to my Instagram. I think it's, I forget what the page is called. It's like a For You. It's a personal page that you can go. I think it's a For You page on Instagram. And I give you like personal updates and things that you don't get necessarily on the rest of my social media. I've been a little bit ill, so I haven't engaged as much as I should, but I promise you I will. Our TikTok is on fire, everyone. So if you have not joined us on TikTok, you are missing out. Our Instagram is on fire, Facebook as well. X is, you know, there's some, you know, there's a lot of haters on there. But, you know, it is what it is, which is the reason I wanted to join it, is to have a voice there, wanted to rejoin in, at least. Okay, so thank you guys for joining. I'll see you tomorrow, if not sooner, if something happens. So Lemonheads, Lemonation, have a fantastic evening. Send me what you want to know, questions. Make sure you hit the thumbs up. If you have questions about the book, when you get it and you read it, we'll do like a book club and we'll answer questions. We'll read, you will do some reading online, etc. So go and pre-order, please, and make us proud for the bestsellers list, okay? Have a great evening. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Do you worry about how much someone drinks?
Do you feel angry or depressed most of the time? Do you feel neglected or unloved?
Do you feel that if the drinker loved you, she or he would stop drinking?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, you are not alone.
Not everyone trapped by alcohol is an alcoholic.
Families and friends are suffering too.
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Call 1-866-200-0223 or visit alanon.org/help.
What kind of help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims.
Welcome home, everybody. This is Angela Rye, Andrew Gillum, and Tiffany Cross. You are tuned in to this week's Minipod.
Uh-huh. You know, we do Juneteenth and 4th of July, but we don't say Happy Independence Day. Uh-huh, because that ain't when we got our independence. But we, you know, we eat on both days. Mm-hmm. All right, now, somebody come on in here and bless the food so we can go on and eat. Who was that that died on 4th of July? Larry. Uh-huh, had that bad wreck. You remember? On the 4th. Mm-hmm. Y'all didn't do no sweets. Where the sweets at? I know y'all don't think we just gonna eat all this meat and potato salad. This is strawberry pie in the refrigerator. Okay. Hey, baby, come here. Now, who is your folks? Wendell is your granddaddy, right? Uh-huh, you look just like Wendell. Go in there and fix me something to drink, but don't give me no soda. Give me like a sweet tea and give me a cup of ice with it. Look just like your granddaddy. Mm-hmm.
I love us. I could go to any cookout anywhere on any MLK Boulevard or in any neighborhood and be good.
But the only thing that was missing was Wendafune.
I mean, these are things that are like kind of pop culture-y for us, but yeah. I there is something deeply rooted and special and sentimental about the quote unquote cookout for us. And I wanted to start with something humorous because we always say, like, who's invited to the cookout, who's not invited to the cookout. Yeah. And it's so true because there is, you have to have a certain understanding in community. Now, in transparency, before we're getting ready to record this segment, and these two started potting talking about, I'd rather talk about what food ain't invited to the cookout.
That's what I want to talk about.
And Andrew said macaroni and cheese made on the stovetop.
That's right.
Ain't invited to the cookout. Yeah, if it ain't, if it wasn't on 375 for an hour, we don't want it.
Hello. Hello.
But I was asking Angela, is Tim Scott invited to the cookout? And she said it depends if he put raisins in his potato salad.
Yeah.
Well, I heard on good authority he prefers raisins in the potato salad.
He might, but I want to know what he's going to bring. So sometimes people bring nasty food to the cookout.
Oh, that's true. How do you know if you're going to eat somebody's food at the cookout?
How it looked and who made it.
You know what? This is going to be real shady, but it's how it looks, who made it, and how they look. So, for example...
say more.
If you look like money make you clean inside, but you ain't clean on the outside, I'm not doing it.
Especially if we know you live in a dirty house.
We have a cousin. Yeah. So, my mom's first cousin... I'm going to get in trouble for this, but we going to tell it all on this cookout episode.
You can't tell the name.
Yes, Rhonda. So, my cousin Rhonda, who I love, Rhonda has taught me how to like cook so many things growing up. Rhonda is on a health kick now. So we had a big, huge cookout, but cook-in because it was Christmas time. It was 65 Negroes in the house for Christmas, celebrating the first Christmas that my grandmother was.
Is this the Christmas where you made up a song? The whole family
that
made up
Thanksgiving.
A song?
Oh, okay. So, but for Christmas, everybody wore pajamas because if Graham could stay in pajamas all day, she would. So we wore pajamas. We had gumbo. It was huge, and I was so tired. But Rhonda can cook. So I was like, Rhonda, you coming? And it's 10 of your grandkids, your kids come. What you making? She was like, oh, I'm going to make this tofu sweet potato pie. And this was me. I was like, no. So, Rhonda, I love you. You brought the sweet potato tofu pie. I tried it just because, but I would really like for you to get off
was
your
Was it good?
Head. No!
Tofu is not invited to the cookout.
And she made it with honey because she's not doing sugar right now. Rhonda, please do sugar again. Yeah. I miss you, Rhonda.
Rhonda, you can stay in your kick, but for everybody else,
kick us with the sugar.
Sweet potato pie. Sweet potato pie.
But I was mad. We were tight about it because she can, like, this is a cousin who can, like, she could
burn.
She could literally create a recipe for you and it's going to be good. And this time, she could have left that one. Mm.
My grandmother was like the resident cook. So every July 4th was a huge deal because it was my grandfather's birthday on the 4th. My father's birthday was the 6th. So my cousin Robin's birthday was the 8th. Nobody died on the 4th. Like Miss EJ Speaks. Shout out to Miss EJ Speaks, by the way, for opening the podcast for us. But I think when everybody came over, they were Gladys Reed was my grandmother's name. I said, what Gladys cook? She would start cooking the day before.
She sound like she can cook.
Yeah, she does.
Gladys Reed. Yeah. And she would be up all day. I would be there, her sous chef. And it was like just but that was to our point that we've talked about before. That was her joy.
Yes.
Feeding people. She loved to see people enjoy her food. Mm-hmm. Her potato salad was amazing. Now I'll tell you, as I've gotten into the world, people have